Millions of women worldwide swear by Ovacetol, the number one inositol supplement by Theralogix for balancing hormone levels. Theralogix also offers a wide range of evidence-based fertility supplements for men and women, trusted by the top fertility clinics across the country. All Theralogix products are independently tested and certified for content accuracy, purity, and freedom from contaminants. Theralogix, supplements from science. For this episode, we've partnered with Needed, the leading women's health supplement brand recommended by nutritionally trained practitioners. Did you know that 95% of women who take prenatals are still nutrient deficient? Most prenatals are designed to meet bare minimum needs, not to optimally nourish you. We love that Needed's products are based on the latest clinical research and that they focus on care before, during, and after pregnancy. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.
You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. This is Dr. Carrie Bedian from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas, joined by my wild, wacky, and wonderful co-hosts, Dr. Abby Eblin from Nashville Fertility Center.
Hey, everybody.
And Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello, everyone. Good, good. What have you all been up to?
Good. Spring cleaning. Ugh, 'tis the season.
Yeah. I have a deep, dirty confession.
Tell us your deep, dirty confession.
Tell us, girl.
I've been watching storage porn.
Is that a show?
No, it's what happens when I have probably no fewer than 25 tabs open on my computer of every single type of storage container that you can possibly have. Because I'm getting some storage units put into my garage so that I can corral all my Christmas stuff, really, because it's starting to take over. So I'm getting all the big, like, sterile, big plastic tubs to dump stuff into. And then I have the white tape, and I'm going to label it with my black Sharpie. And then I've got a couple of inside closets that need a little bit of extra help. So while I've been watching big plastic tub porn, I'm doing the more exciting, exotic porn, storage porn of,
And exotic porn.
What to do in your closet?
What to do with my closet?
What to do in your clean closet when you have room?
So this is the excitement of a middle-aged woman. I get thrilled about.
So it sounds like you have really good plans, Carrie. What's your follow-through like? Are you good at, like, if you say you're going to label stuff, do you really do that, or do you like?
Oh yeah,
you do. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh wow. Come to my house, please.
Haven't you seen the files that we share together?
Oh my god. You're pretty obsessive when it comes to that. Yeah, that's true.
She's a good labeler.
You just edited my chapter. Like, there's line numbers on everyone. There's a header on everything. There's a photo.
I know.
Numbers get a little overwhelming to me sometimes.
Well, no, actually, they came in really handy because, like, there was one place where you mentioned something, and I'm like, oh yeah, you mentioned that on line 125. So it was good. It was helpful. So obsessive.
For those of you who don't know what we're talking about when we're talking about line numbers, we are currently writing a book, which we are very excited about, and we're all writing it
on IVF.
About IVF. And so we each have different chapters we're writing, but then we're all going in back and editing and adding and putting in our voices and those types of things. And so it's been really fun. But I have to say, the problem with line numbers is if you have already been editing, and this happened between me and Carrie one time. I had something, and she randomly sends me a text. Hey, I think you misspoke on this one line here. And it, of course, she referenced the line number. And I was like, well, considering those line numbers are not all the same anymore.
Yeah. That's
so
right.
Don't worry. I took a screenshot and then used the edit function on my phone to point out where exactly it was in the paragraph that needed to be looked at.
It was very cute.
Oh, that's right. Because you're saying after you make your insertions, it's the line numbers are different.
The line numbers change.
Yeah. But it's really helpful when you're doing a massive change because you can just say, you know, this goes line 242 and you just take the whole paragraph and go. And it was helpful.
it was.
But, you know.
Did you have to type in all those line numbers or did
Word do it? No, it's a part of the Word document.
Okay. You just go to the insert menu. Yeah. Okay. I'm sure all of our listeners are super excited about
documents. So Susan, tell us about your spring. What's your spring cleaning? Now, you didn't tell me about your spring cleaning yet.
Oh, my spring cleaning, it's definitely it. My biggest things I like to hit are closets and drawers. But I have to, I'm very linear when I do this. And what I mean by that is I have to start at one part of the room and I walk my way like along the wall of the closet or the wall of the room with drawers, like your bathroom or something like that. I have to start at one place and progress in a very orderly fashion. If you haven't noticed, we all have a little OCD going on here.
Well, my OCD that I've started noticing is I'm very good at grouping things that belong together. So like I'll go like to five different rooms to find the pillowcase that goes with this pillowcase or, you know, it's like, I don't want a random something here. I like things grouped together that belong together. That's my OCD thing.
I would love to group all my pillowcases and stuff.
I think all three of us combined would have a great house cleaning business.
We would. We would.
Yeah.
We need a lot of OCD medicine though, but.
All right. So house cleaning aside, what kind of questions do we have today?
All right. So our first question today is, hello, ladies. Thank you very much for all you do. I absolutely love your podcast and has helped answered many of my questions throughout my own IVF journey. My question for you is, what are the rules with flying with IVF medication? I will be traveling in the next month for a couple of days, and if I'm taking shots at that time, will altitude cause the little jars that hold the medication sterile water to explode? What about the Follistim cartridges? Will I need to pack these into my checked bag, or can I bring these medications and needles through security in my carry-on? Thank you very much for your answers. Isn't this a great question?
It's a fabulous question.
My funny answer to that, and this may sound smart, but I just had this vision of like the container exploding. I thought, well, if the container explodes, you would explode too, because it would mean the cabin's depressurized probably. So good news is most people don't explode on the airplane. Although, you know, these days with things going on the airplane, you never know what's going to happen. But yeah, I've never had a problem with anybody getting needles or syringes through security. If you're really worried and you think that could be a problem, you can always have your doctor write a note. But I have never had a problem with that. It doesn't impact the medications when you fly with them. You know, you probably don't want them to be sitting on a runway in, you know, San Antonio, Texas or something in the middle of the summertime. You know, you probably carry them on your carry-on bag. Just don't put them in the suitcase like any medicine. You don't want them to be sent somewhere else. But most people do fine with traveling with their medications.
Mm-hmm. If you need to keep them cold, it's a lot easier to get ice, like an ice pack frozen solid through security than just a cold pack. So, you know, take that tip for what it's worth. A lot of the time it's not an issue with meds that you're taking with you, but you know, should it be, that's one way to do it. I would definitely err on the side of as much of it as you can take that's fully labeled, do that, because that makes it really easy for them to look at it and go, oh God, I don't want to mess with this. This is all really well documented.
We're not going to ask her any questions.
Yeah. Like there's a ton of paperwork that goes with this in terms of the prescription and the labeling from the pharmacy and all of that. So would leave that intact as best you can. Plus the note from your doc.
Yeah. Easy to get that note from your doc. Keep it on you at all times because you don't want to get separated. I think we've all had that phone call from somebody. Oh no, I flew to so-and-so and my luggage ended up not getting there with me. And now I don't have my blank. So don't put yourself in that position. If for some reason you have to like not have it all as your carry-on, have enough that you have a couple of days with you though. So that gives you time to get something in an emergent situation.
Mm-hmm. Buy yourself time.
Exactly. Exactly. One more question. Do you think that progesterone supplementation can be helpful when trying to conceive naturally based on progesterone testing? And if you think it's helpful, would you recommend it to women over 40? Thanks.
So progesterone supplementation based on testing is a challenging one to answer because you never really know, is it truly because the progesterone's low or is the progesterone low because the corpus luteum is not super functional? And is the corpus luteum not super functional, because the egg is not super functional? And is that why you're not getting pregnant? And the progesterone is just a red herring that sends you off on a crazy little wild goose chase. So I don't think it's ever technically a problem when you take additional progesterone when you're trying to supplement getting to a pregnancy naturally. Functionally, I think it's a pain in the neck. And it drives you crazy far more than it drives us crazy, primarily because, number one, if you do it wrong, it acts as birth control. And that is very much not the point. Secondly, even if you have absolutely rigid, perfect, gorgeous cycles that are every 28 days, and we're going to go into funky bleeding and is the topic of this episode. So this is a great segue for that. But if you have beautiful 28-day cycles, taking progesterone is going to screw it up because progesterone is going to delay your cycle. And so even if you check on the 28th day and say, okay, my pregnancy test is negative and you stop the progesterone, all of a sudden your period's not going to come till day 31, 34, somewhere in there, and your cycle's off. And now you don't know how to count the same way that you otherwise would. So by the time you get 2 or 3 months into this, everything has gone to hell and you're annoyed. And it ends up being more problematic. So functionally, most of us supplement either after an IUI because the timing is rock solid, or once you were actually pregnant, because the data doesn't really support a whole lot of that 2-week window in between ovulation and a positive test.
Carrie alluded to the fact that timing's important. So usually after ovulation is the time you want to start progesterone. If you start it beforehand, that's where it can be a problem in terms of altering the window of implantation, make it harder for you to get pregnant. I think most of us would agree, though, if you are really worried and you want to take it and you're okay with the timing, it's probably fine. To use Carrie's own words, it's like dumping water in the ocean. So you have probably a bunch of progesterone. Taking a little bit more is not a big deal, but you just have to be prepared for the fact that your cycles are probably going to be lengthened just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I would like to warn people about when they're worried about progesterone levels, okay? So there are some better tests out there, things like Prove, and I think we've had an episode or two in the past from the Prove folks to kind of explain how their device works. How, if you're doing these changes based on a single cycle day 21 progesterone, realize that your progesterone level goes up and down all day long. Okay, so whatever your value is, we don't know with that single spot check whether or not you're at a peak or a trough. So at the very high point or the very low point or somewhere in between. The other thing that I often see in people who come in, they will feel like, well, I had a negative pregnancy test. The progesterone related to my negative pregnancy test was low. You can't use that one, okay? The real value of progesterone, the cycle day 21, is to prove whether or not you ovulated, not necessarily the strength of the ovulation. And that progesterone with a negative HCG, you really can't bank on anything with that one.
Yeah. So let's use this as a springboard into our super fabulous topic today, which is funky bleeding. And one of the things that I think all of us in all of the super fancy cocktail parties that we go to, this is one of the topics that gets brought
funky
up
bleeding
on a regular
questions.
Basis.
Yeah.
Bleeding because all you have to do is say you're a gynecologist and all the information comes out. And part of that is screwball periods. So in order to know what's screwy, you got to know what's not screwy. So what are the criteria for a normal cycle that we are looking for?
So I would say a 28-day cycle would be a perfect cycle. Not everybody can set their clock by it. And sometimes when people come in, they'll be like, oh, my cycles are irregular. And if they're off by a day or two, that doesn't count as being irregular. For us, we're thinking more than 34 days, like less than 25 days, if they're really short or really long, those are kind of screwball cycles. We don't really know what's going on with those cycles or bleeding in between. That's the other screwball thing that can happen.
Another thing that can be that helps us define normality with periods and bleeding is how long are you actually bleeding, and kind of a little bit quantity-wise, are you bleeding a whole lot or are you bleeding like essentially not at all and having just a few little spots? So I would say a period that is 7 days or less is usually in a normal range. Most people will bleed, I would say, for at least 4 days. And most people are going to start off with heavier bleeding that gradually lightens. But then we get into all the funky things.
So let's start going through funky things that we get asked questions about all the time. And so funky item number one is spotting. And let's talk about spotting right around the period. So let's say your patient comes in and she says, okay, I'm trying to figure out when is the first day of my period because I spot for 3 or 4 days and then I start bleeding. So is that my period?
So usually we say no, it's got to be first full day of flow is when you have a period. So first morning that you bleed. And I don't know that anybody really knows. This goes back to what you said about progesterone carry. Or at least I tend to think that maybe their corpus luteum has kind of given out a little bit too soon. So that's the cyst that contained the egg. Once the egg is released, that cyst produces progesterone. Peak production is around cycle day 21, sometimes 22, 23, but then it starts to taper off if you're not pregnant. And so some people can, if the progesterone level tapers off too quickly, some people can start to have spotting related to that.
So when someone has spotting that's not right before their cycle, so let's say they have their period, they definitively get it and they definitively stop it. And then somewhere right around the middle of their cycle, they have some spotting there. How much worry do you have to give to that?
Medium. And the reason why I say medium is because sometimes it can be a positive thing, but sometimes it can be a negative thing. So we've all heard about implantation bleeding and that type of thing. But realistically, that shouldn't be exactly mid-cycle. Because if you're implanting, that's
mid-cycle.
that's five days after you've ovulated, actual implantation happening. Okay. And so when I hear about mid-cycle bleeding, I often think about either a hormonal issue or I'm thinking about a structural issue. When I think of the hormonal issues, I want to make sure that your thyroid is working well. I want to make sure your prolactin, a little hormone secreted by your brain that normally makes women get breast milk after they have babies. If it's off, that can increase the likelihood of that mid-cycle spotting. But sometimes you can have structural abnormalities like polyps or fibroids, which we'll dive into a little bit, that can cause you to have that bleeding mid-cycle as well.
Receptiva DX is a powerful test that can help detect inflammatory conditions on the uterine lining that might be preventing you from becoming pregnant or staying pregnant. If you've experienced implantation failure or recurrent pregnancy loss, ask your doctor about Receptiva DX testing. If found, uterine inflammation can be treated, providing a new pathway to achieving a successful pregnancy. Receptiva DX, because the journey's worth it.
So let's get on to heavier issues than just spotting. So what about the folks who come in and they say, every time I get a period, I bleed heavily for at least 2 weeks. And I stop and then I get another period, but it's a really long lasting flow. What do we think about those patients?
I tend to think of more about structural problems like Susan's talking about. And usually it's not polyps. Polyps can have caused some irregular bleeding, but for people who have really heavy periods, I worry that they have fibroids, which are benign tumors that grow inside the cavity. They can also grow on the wall of the cavity. And a lot of times the ones that are inside the cavity, they can irritate and cause friction. And a lot of times, for whatever reason, that can make people continue to bleed. And sometimes they're not even that big compared to some of the other ones patients may have that are further away from the cavity. But if they irritate the cavity, we tend to think that those probably cause more heavy bleeding. I think sometimes to the extreme, and this would be really unusual, but particularly in an adolescent patient, a young patient that bleeds real heavily, the other thing I think about are bleeding disorders, particularly in a younger patient who hadn't had many periods but has really heavy periods to start off with. And then sometimes we can also see really heavy periods in women who are obese. Obesity increases estrogen, and estrogen, if you chronically give a woman, even a thin woman, estrogen just continuously over time, their endometrial lining will build up. And eventually it'll start to lose blood supply and it'll start to break off and bleed at different times. And so sometimes those patients can just have bleeding for weeks and weeks on end without stopping. So those are sort of the big ones I would think about. And cancer related to that as well. The heavier the bleeding and the thicker the lining, longer it goes on, the more likely you are to have some sort of cancer, like endometrial cancer of the lining.
Then the cancer part is very, very rare, especially in reproductive age women.
But yes, it is.
It's not non-existent. I would say we all diagnose endometrial cancer a few times a year, unfortunately. And a lot of the story of what we're talking about here is not necessary. Well, especially if you're thinking of things like blood disorders, clotting disorders, those types of things versus structural things that develop over time, a lot of what we're needing from your history is, when did this happen? Have your periods always been this way? Okay. Or have they, you had normal periods and then something changed?
Absolutely. So when you've got someone who comes in and I saw somebody like this earlier this week. She said, my periods were kind of off and on for a while. They were fine. Like, I got them regularly enough. And for the past year and a half, I essentially have not stopped bleeding.
Yeah.
What do we think about first in terms of diagnosis? And then we'll talk about treatment in a second for that kind of bleeding. But what do you think for with diagnosis when you're seeing that level of bleeding where it is going on and on forever?
I mean, there's a lot of different things we may want to do. I would do a blood count first. Not that this would help with diagnostically, but just that if you've been bleeding a long time, I want to make sure you're not severely anemic. So blood count. Susan mentioned things like hormonal tests, like thyroid and prolactin. I would think about doing an endometrial biopsy to get a sampling of the endometrium. And then the other testing we may want to do is a saline sonogram so that we can see, you know, what the shape of the fibroid, or if you have any growths inside your cavity, like polyps or fibroids, and, you know, if those are things that could be contributing to the irregular bleeding.
So once you've got enough information and you know, okay, I need to go inside to look at this, because I think there's enough going on that merits me putting a camera in and looking in. Can you do that when someone's bleeding heavily?
So we can if we need to. I mean, it's ideal for us to potentially start giving you some medicine to kind of staunch the bleeding. Okay. Kind of the way we think about it when we're thinking about what kind of medicine might help you is, if we think that this is a situation where you might be lacking in either estrogen or progesterone, we might give you one or the other, and sometimes a combination, like birth control pills. Because even if we can slow down the bleeding, then that's going to help us with the visualization. Now, there's a procedure that we can perform that is what we call a blind procedure, that we don't actually look in the uterus, but we essentially kind of remove the lining of the uterus by feel, a DNC, which is something that we can do. But as reproductive endocrinologists, we really like to stick a camera in there and see exactly what's going on, see structurally exactly what's going on. Can we see the openings to both fallopian tubes? Does there look like there's inflammation there? Do we see structurally polyps there? Do we see a fibroid? And then be able to attack that. So, you know, a lot of times people will call us and they'll be like, oh, I'm having a little bit of bleeding. I'm scheduled for my hysteroscopy. Is that okay? That is probably fine. If you are having heavy, heavy bleeding, which we consider heavy bleeding, you're soaking a maxi pad an hour, okay? And that's one of those thick ones, not those little thin ones everyone uses nowadays, for 2 hours in a row. That's heavy enough bleeding that you need to call your doctor immediately, and you probably need to be boogieing onto your emergency room.
Yeah, and I would say if you're going to have surgery, ideally, unless it's life-threatening bleeding, really, we don't want you to have any bleeding, because it's really hard to see. I mean, I guess it's possible, but it looks murky and it's hard to see. It's hard to really see what we need to do. And so kind of back to what Susan said, I think if you're having real heavy bleeding, kind of like, again, it could be estrogen, it could be just progesterone, or it could be like a birth control pill pack, and maybe even two or three of them together in a real short window of time over a few weeks' time, because high dose estrogen and progesterone helps stabilize your endometrium. That helps it prevent it from breaking off in little tiny pieces. Sometimes if you have something called dysfunctional bleeding, it just means that your body doesn't really know what it's supposed to be doing. So at some point or at the same time, some of your lining is growing and the other time, and at the same time, some of your lining is sloughing off, so that there's really never a time that you're not having bleeding. And so birth control pills are really helpful in that regard. If you give them in high dosage for really a fairly short period of time, it will stabilize the endometrium, stop your bleeding. Then we can go in and see, you know, what we need to see at that time.
So if you've got a patient who you need to give whatever form of hormones to, usually we're giving them for a short burst of time in order to get the bleeding to stop. So she takes it and her bleeding stops. Is everything fixed?
No. We have stabilized things. Okay. We have stabilized things. And as you mentioned, it's usually a short time period, but it's stabilized. We still need to go in, see what's going on through some sort of, whether it's a hysteroscopy or a saline ultrasound or whatever it is, for us to make sure that everything is safe for us to move forward. Because remember, our number one priority for you guys is always safety, and baby's number two.
Mm-hmm. When we are going through and cycling someone on progesterone or estrogen, whatever it may be, with these kind of wild and crazy periods, a lot of times what we will do is tell people straight off, this first period after the progesterone, because it's more often than not, it's progesterone that we're using, because fertility patients, if you say, here, take this birth control pill, they think you have lost your ever loving mind. Yeah. And so we have not, and we know that. And so we'll give progesterone for 7 days, 10 days, whatever it may be. You'll stop bleeding. And then once you go off, you'll get a heavy bleed. So I always prep my patients, this first bleed, maybe the first or second or third ones, they're going to be big and nasty and brutal, because this is the first set of organized instructions your uterus has had to get rid of it. And then you're going to go back on the progesterone again, and it's going to stabilize. And then your next bleed is going to be just a little bit better. And then you do that for a few months so that you can safely spring clean without just hemorrhaging forever in a way that is not conducive to your health, peace of mind, or getting anything done that we want to do for your fertility.
So Kiri didn't come right out and say this, but those patients that usually respond to progesterone that are usually in that situation usually have a condition which many of you may be real familiar with, polycystic ovary syndrome. Because, you know, if you go months and months and months and months without having a period, your body is still making that endometrium. It's still building up inside you. It's just your body's not giving you the trigger to release that. And so over time, as that lining gets thicker and thicker and thicker, as I was saying before, it eventually outgrows its blood supply. And that's where that whole process of some breaking off and bleeding and other continued growth starts. So by kind of just wiping the slate clean, giving someone progesterone, and then more importantly, when you stop it, that gives your body the trigger, which you've never gotten before or hadn't gotten in a long time, to release all that lining. And that's why it's so heavy, because your lining may be really thick and you may have a lot to really get out in that first period.
So let's flip to the opposite end of the spectrum. And someone says, I am having funky bleeding and it just doesn't come. Like, I had a period in April and it's now, you know, the next year and I still haven't had one. What is going on?
There's a couple of things that could be going on. Most likely, believe it or not, you're not having bleeding probably because of an ovary issue. Okay. The two ovary issues that we're usually the most concerned about are the polycystic ovaries, like we just talked about, because without ovulation and that process occurring correctly, you're not going to build up your lining and then shed your lining in an organized fashion. The other side of that is severe diminished ovarian reserve, which is where your ovaries are almost out of eggs. Okay. You still have some. Okay. But they may not be as good or at the high enough quantity to make that ovulatory cycle happen. Okay. And both of those can create a situation where you don't have the correct lining being formed and then not having anything to shed.
A couple others I can think of too are a condition that we've talked about. It's been a while since we've talked about it, but it's called the athlete's triad or hypothalamic amenorrhea. So sometimes patients that exercise a lot, and it can be a combination of three different things, or it can be each one individually to extreme. So if you're anorexic, or if you limit what you eat in terms of calories, if you have a significant amount of stress, or you do a significant amount of exercise, your body just doesn't feel like it's a good time for you to be pregnant. And so your brain just doesn't talk to your ovary. It doesn't send the signal, the luteinizing hormone and the FSH, to make you develop eggs and ultimately develop estrogen. If you don't develop estrogen, you don't build up a lining. So if you haven't had a period in about 6 months, you know, sometimes we'll see patients in that condition. The other condition that we may see that in is
Before you get onto Asherman's, I want to mention something. I've seen quite a few patients recently who have, for a period of time, decided to do bodybuilding and go into those types of competitions. And they
I can do it.
And they what happens is they get very, very lean. They have very, very fat tissue in their body, which is great for the bodybuilding, but your body is actually programmed to require a certain percentage of body fat to go through this reproductive process. And you know, there are even people that once they regain that body fat, that their brain and ovaries kind of forget how to make that happen again. And so that's, you know, it's not an official part of, you know, the hypothalamic amenorrhea type of thing. And I've seen people who, you know, they've gone through this, you test their hormones, their FSH, their LH, and those look normal, but they're still not having ovulatory cycles. So that's something else that can kick your body into not having periods.
Yeah. And I've seen that condition. I've seen that where it doesn't come back in a patient who had anorexia when she was a teenager and she got over the anorexia, but her hypothalamic pituitary just didn't communicate with her ovary even after she gained it, got to normal body weight.
For our listeners, the building block for absolutely every hormone that we know, love, and go to sleep dreaming about, the building block that every single one of those starts with is cholesterol. Mm-hmm. And so no cholesterol, no estrogen, no progesterone, yep. No testosterone, none of it. And so that's part of the reason why we really do pay attention to body fat. And there's no magical number that says, if you have X amount, you'll do well, because having too little is problematic because you don't get any periods, and having too much is problematic because that can lead to extra estrogen production and screwball bleeding in that way, where you end up with too much. All right. We were going to talk about Asherman's.
One other condition is Asherman syndrome. And that's a condition, essentially, it's a condition where you have scar tissue in your uterus. And so a lot of times it's iatrogenic, meaning something was done to you that scarred your lining. And so a lot of times it's linked to women after they've had a baby. If they've had a placenta, a retained placenta, particularly after they've just had a baby, their estrogen level's low. And then on top of that, if they've got retained placenta, a lot of times they'll have a DNC right at that time when their estrogen's really low, and their estrogen stays pretty low for a while, particularly if they're going to breastfeed. And so therefore, it doesn't heal very well and it causes scarring. The other time I've seen that happen, and I've seen actually a couple people lately that have had IUDs in. And, you know, we think of IUD as a great birth control method, and it is, but I've actually seen a handful of 3 or 4 people recently who've come in that with that scenario, they had the IUD taken out and they didn't start their period 6 months later, and then they have some scar tissue. So, and then just routine DNCs, if you've had multiple ones of those, usually it's more than just one, though, that can cause scarring as well.
So when I think about the DNCs that cause scarring, the ones that I'm most concerned about is if you've had a baby before and maybe you've had a retained placenta, part of the afterbirth was stuck and they had to manually remove that. That's when I think we see a lot of it. And mm-hmm. I know we have listeners also outside of the United States where we have higher incidences of diseases like tuberculosis, mm-hmm. which yeah. can also cause scarring in the lining of the uterus.
Mm-hmm. Now, for everyone who is listening, who is absolutely panicking right now because, oh my God, I had an IUD. My doctor told me it was safe. How could they not know? I had a DNC. My doctor told me it was going to be fine. How dare they do that? All of that. We are talking about such extraordinarily low numbers and percentages. Right. We are talking about way less than 1% here. So please take a deep breath. Put down the phone. Don't call your sister or your best friend. She does not need to have her IUD pulled right away. It's going to be okay. But these are really rare events, but we see them because we deal with that.
We see the exceptional cases. You know, if they were the cases that everybody could handle, they would be, they're going to be at the general OB/GYN and getting those things taken care of there. Often we see the things that other people haven't necessarily been able to figure out or fix quite yet.
But I will say, in a couple of my patients, they kept waiting and waiting and waiting for their period. And they'd had regular periods before the IUD. If you haven't had a period in 6 months and you used to have regular periods, or even if you didn't have regular periods, you need to go see your OBGYN and figure out what's going on. Don't wait another 6 months to figure out that all of a sudden something else is going on. So if you had normal cycles before, they should cycle pretty normally not too long after you get your IUD out.
All right. Any last things to add that we have not covered on screwball bleeding that the American public needs to know?
I have one. So also, it's important to know that, you know, if you have regular menstrual periods and maybe you have some bleeding when your period's supposed to start, but it's not a completely normal period, pee on a stick.
Okay. Preferably a pregnancy test as opposed to your neighbor's front yard, but
yes, yes,
do you.
Yes. Pee on a pregnancy stick, okay? Because, you know, we have it all the time. I'll have somebody call the office. Oh, we did a cycle with you guys last cycle, but I started bleeding and I don't want to do a pregnancy test at this point. And I'm like, but we need to, because not all bleeding at the time of your period is actually a period. And yeah. We've had people who, you know, were out in the world and it's like, oh, but I had bleeding. And it's like, yeah, that was just like some bleeding in early pregnancy and you're actually pregnant. I actually had a patient one time who came in and she was pretty far along because she had just ignored those types of signs.
I had somebody that came along and was 14 weeks pregnant and she didn't know she was pregnant. So I did her ultrasound and saw her baby moving inside.
I had a new patient one time who had PCOS. She was overweight and she had a long history of irregular cycles. Ooh, here's a good one. And she took, with her general OB/GYN, she had taken some Provera, some progesterone to make her have a period. And she never had a period after she took her progesterone. If you take progesterone and you don't have a period, call your doctor.
Let your doctor know.
Let your doctor know, because she didn't have a period because she was pregnant. So she comes to see me, and I'm not kidding you, she was 32 weeks pregnant.
Whoa. I thought 14 was pretty big, but wow, 32.
I started off with, you know, we had gone through our whole history, so like a typical PCOS patient. And then went to do the ultrasound and I put in the vaginal probe ultrasound and all I could see was skull. And I was like, I think I'm gonna do an abdominal ultrasound right now just to kind of get a full look of everything.
There's a wiggling baby.
There was a wiggling baby. So it was a big shock to Ruth. It was very good news, but we got her into her OB/GYN right away.
And she delivered really, it was the shortest pregnancy she'll ever have.
It was a fun day.
One last thing I was going to add in, supplements. So if you're on supplements from the internet, or if you're taking aspirin or any kind of blood thinner or Lovenox or Xarelto, that can make you bleed. So if you're having irregular bleeding, that may be part of the reason. But I think supplements, I mean, I think people understand with blood thinners probably, they could have irregular bleeding, but I think a lot of people don't understand that there's supplements that you can take that can make your blood more likely to flow, and therefore you may have irregular bleeding related to that.
All good notes. Yay. All right. So to our audience, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for more. Subscribe again if you have not done that recently. They changed all the algorithms and we don't want to...
we don't want to be left behind.
We don't want to be left behind, but we don't want you to think that we are deserting you either, because we love you and we have not abandoned you. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on YouTube. So hop on by and leave us a like and a hello and a follow.
You can also visit fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions you have about infertility. All questions will be answered on the podcast anonymously for our Ask the Doc segment, so don't hold back. We also love episode ideas, so let us know what you're thinking and want to hear.
And as always, this podcast is intended for entertainment. It's not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Millions of women worldwide swear by Ovacetol, the number one inositol supplement by Theralogix for balancing hormone levels. Theralogix also offers a wide range of evidence-based fertility supplements for men and women, trusted by the top fertility clinics across the country. All Theralogix products are independently tested and certified for content accuracy, purity, and freedom from contaminants. Theralogix, supplements from science. Fertility is complex, and while there's a lot we can't control in the journey to parenthood, nutrition is a big one that both partners can. This is why we've teamed up with Needed, a perinatal nutrition company that optimizes nutrition for both partners throughout all stages of pregnancy. They offer a variety of products to support women and their partners on their journey to conception, including their fertility support for two plan. Support your body with radically better nutrition and save 20% off with your first month at thisisneeded.com with code FDU.